Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role did Bill Haley play in the creation of rock and roll, and why have his contributions been treated as footnotes rather than a chapter in music history? As early as the late 1940s, Haley was recording Western swing tracks with hints of the new sound he would help pioneer. And then in 1954 came the song that would change everything.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me home. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes 2, 3, and 4, if the band slows down, we'll yell for more. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight.
That was Rock Around the Clock, the single that made Bill Haley and his Comets world famous. John Lennon would credit Haley for inspiring him to take up the guitar, and a newcomer named Elvis Presley served on numerous occasions as the Comets' opening act. So why did Elvis and Lennon remain household words decades after their deaths while Haley's star faded? Michael Hall is senior editor at Texas Monthly. His article, Falling Comet, appears in the current issue of the magazine. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Haley's career started with a bang. We heard that unforgettable song. Ended in some ways with a whimper. You start the piece at the end of his life, which he lived out in large part in Harlingen, less like a retired superstar than a retired small business owner.
Yeah, that's definitely true. He actually spent the last 20 years of his life living back and forth between Texas and Mexico, but the last 5 years in Harlingen, yeah, just kind of walking and driving around town, and he was not like the big rock star. Yeah, it's exactly right. He hid his identity. He wore a gimme cap, and he just wandered around town. He wasn't not going around with the big rock and roll pedigree. Definitely not.
And it's a poignant detail that he hung out at this diner often, and sort of hoped against hope that he might be recognized.
Yeah, I mean his whole life he was a private guy, you know, even in early on in his career, but at the end, I mean, he would, like I say, he would wear a gimme cap and these big glasses, so he didn't really look like, you know, everybody knew who he was at a certain point, but he definitely tried to hide his identity, and yet he also still wanted some kind of recognition. He would a waitress at this Sambo's said that he would sit there and he'd be real quiet, he'd mind his own business, and then he'd start humming one of his songs. And what he really wanted to do was inspire the person next to him to say, "Are you Bill Haley?"
Well, so many of those songs are still instantly recognizable to people who grew up long after they were released initially. Part of the reason, I guess, that we didn't talk so much about Haley was that his widow, Martha, had until very recently really fiercely guarded his privacy. What concerned her about telling his story?
Well, she was devastated by his death. She was much younger when they got married and really devoted her life to him. And, you know, she was from Mexico. They married in Mexico. They, like I say, they moved back and forth in Texas and Mexico. And they started a family, and she was absolutely devoted to him. She would go on the road with him. She would take care of him. And personally, she was really devastated by his death. And his last few years were not pleasant. He was an alcoholic, and he had a lot of problems dealing with that, and she had a lot of problems dealing with that. And she, you know, Bill Haley had this reputation for so long as being this smiley-faced rock and roll, you know, king. I mean, he was the first king of rock and roll, and she wanted that to be the image that people people kept of him, when, you know, in fact, toward the end, he was not that at all. He was a real live human being who had a disease. And so she was very careful. She really wanted to protect that.
It's an interesting detail that ultimately, really, it was their children who convinced her to open up. And there are things that come out during the time that you're reporting this piece that they were hearing from her for the first time as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was all of them live in Dallas and North Dallas. And so when their two children, Martha Maria and Pedro, talked her into talking, we all got together. And it was clear that they were hearing things. I was hearing things for the first time. I was hearing things at the same time they were hearing them for the first time in their lives. And a lot of this because there were times apparently she wouldn't allow them to talk about him at all growing up because it was so painful for her. She wouldn't allow them to talk about their dad. And so a lot of the stories never got told, and some of them are just these wonderful stories, and you know, the story of how they met and how they fell in love. It's this amazingly romantic story, and so I was hearing, my jaw was dropping at the same time that Pedro and Martha Maria were hearing these great stories.
Well, for one thing, for her, and she was not a kid, but she was very, very young when they met, and
yeah.
For her, it was love at first sight. She was going to be like a background performer in one of his shows in Mexico, and it took him, first of all, he had a complicated life, but it took him a little longer to see how wonderful she was.
Yeah, I mean, and I think he was, when they first meet, she tells a great story that's in the Texas Monthly story about, she was this very chatty, she was a performer. She wasn't just a backup singer. She was a lead singer. She was actually pretty well known. And she would get up on this was an era where they would load up into these two double-decker buses, all these entertainers. There would be singers, bands, jugglers, and we'd travel around Mexico to towns and cities and put on shows. And Bill Haley, for all kinds of reasons, wasn't doing that well in the States anymore, and he was coming down to Mexico, and he was doing great, and so they stuck him on this thing and told him that he had to perform with a female singer because that's what the people in Mexico expect, and he fought that, and he finally gave in, and they told her, Martha, that she was going to perform with this rock star, and she basically said, well, okay, I'll do that. And then they got together, and he was considerably older than her, I think about 15 years older than her. And the first time they meet, he's kind of stumbles onto the bus, and he has a hangover, and she is this super chatty woman. And Bill Haley says to his friend Rudy, who's his right-hand man, how do you say in Spanish, shut up, broad? You know, it's just like this, you know, they don't hit it off well at first, although she does see something in him. She says in the story that, you know, there was something about him that really got her. And it, for her, it was love at first sight. It wasn't until the next night when he saw her in the light of, you know, before a performance that he fell in love with her.
So let's talk about his early career. He came from a musical family, and his first love was country music. When did he start recording?
He started recording in the 40s when he was a teenager. He grew up in eastern Pennsylvania and loved cowboy songs, loved Gene Autry and loved these old cowboy songs. And he started performing with these groups. I think his first band was called the Texas Range Riders. He loved Texas music. And he would sing these cowboy songs with these other young people. I mean, he was a teenager, and they would perform around these state fairs and places. And I don't think he started recording until he'd been doing that a few years, and he started making some early, they're like swing records. He loved Bob Wills. And it's not, this is a Pennsylvanian, so they're using instead of a fiddle, they're using an accordion. But it's this really cool mix of this kind of, you know, these Pennsylvania kids. Bob Wills' father was from Kentucky. He played, Bill Haley's father was from Kentucky. He played mandolin and banjo. So Bill Haley and his mother was a classical pianist from England. So he grew up with all these different musical influences. And then he falls in love with this Texas cowboy songs and this swing, and so he kind of creates this really cool swing music, this kind of Pennsylvania version of Texas swing.
So we have first Bill Haley and his Texas Range Riders, then the Four Aces of Western Swing, and what we're about to hear right now is 1951 Rocket 88, Bill Haley and his Saddlemen.
The noise they make, let me introduce you to my Rocket 88. Yes, it's great, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Cows will ride in style, moving all along. And the gals don't mind sporting with me, riding all around town, boys.
Bill Haley and his Saddlemen there from 1951, Rocket 88. You know, Michael Hall, what I love about that song is that it absolutely feels like you're sitting right on the precipice between sort of that swing era and what would become rock and roll.
And that's exactly where you're sitting. I mean, you can really hear it. You can hear history being made right then. I mean, it's this swing, this country band playing this R&B song that had recently been covered by Ike Turner's band. But they kind of bring this kind of loping, you know, thing to it. It's a white thing, and they're doing a black song. But what is it? You know, you can't really tell. It's this kind of new thing that they're making up on the spot.
And in fact, in the late 40s, when Haley was working as a DJ in Pennsylvania, he was a rare white DJ who was perfectly okay with playing black artists.
Yeah, he loved R&B music, and he was a DJ who liked to play it. And then he became a program director at this station in Chester, and he actually created a show that just played R&B. And so, you know, I mean, he was fully aware of all the different kinds of music, and then his band started playing this stuff, and the kids loved it. You know, I mean, we're talking, you know, playing at high school dances and things like that, and the kids just couldn't believe what they were hearing. You know, it was just this new thing, and the dance floor would fill up.
Did he understand at the time that he would be a performer for the rest of his life? I guess at the time, it was not unusual at all to work at a radio station, but to also be an active musician.
You know, that's a good question. I mean, he's a really interesting guy, but he was very shy. And this was after a period where he'd been working as a performer, and he'd kind of given it up. He'd kind of lost faith in himself in some ways, and because he wasn't like this natural, you know, guy getting up there and doing all this crazy stuff on stage. He was a shy guy, and so he became a DJ, and they kind of dragged him back into performing, and he kept doing it, and you know, he was never that guy like Elvis who would get up there and, you know, swivel the hips, and he was not that kind of an entertainer.
Michael Hall is with us. He's senior editor at Texas Monthly Magazine, which features his article Falling Comet in the June 2011 issue. We'll talk more about Bill Haley and his comets after this break. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
We're going to tear down the mailbox, rip up the floor, smash out the windows, and knock down the door. We're going to rock.
Rock this joint, we're gonna rock. Rock this joint, we're gonna rock. Rock this joint, we're gonna rock this joint tonight. Well, six times six is 36. I ain't gonna hit for six more licks. We're gonna rock. Rock this joint, we're gonna rock. Rock this joint, we're gonna rock. Rock this joint, we're gonna rock this joint tonight.
That was Bill Haley and his Saddlemen from 1952, Rock This Joint. My guest this hour has written an article about Bill Haley called Falling Comet for the June 2011 issue of Texas Monthly Magazine. He is senior editor Michael Hall. If you want to be part of our conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You mentioned that he wasn't like a hip-swiveling Elvis on stage, but he did have a look that is pretty unforgettable, and in fact, a look that he kept throughout the rest of his life, including that famous curl over his right eye, which was not so much a way of drawing attention to himself as drawing attention away from his left eye.
Yeah, when Bill was four, he had had an operation on his ear, and the doctors had accidentally severed his optic nerve or damaged it, and it made him blind. And so for the rest of his life, he was very self-conscious about it, and when he was a kid, you know, I mean, other kids would make fun of him and all, and when he got older, when he started to be a performer, he had a cowlick, a natural cowlick, and he would bring down this curl over the right side to take, in his mind, it would take away the attention from his left eye. He was so self-conscious about his left eye, he came up with, you know, a plan. And that's why in every single picture you see of Bill Haley, he has that curve. Anytime he performed, clearly, but anytime he went out in public, I mean, that was always, the curl was always there. And that became his real trademark. And, you know, in some ways, it kind of turned him into this kind of this caricature, you know, this, because it was, you know, to me, it looks like, you know, the Gerber baby or something. You know, it's not... You know, it didn't look natural. It looked kind of like a shtick. And I think ultimately that, you know, that took away from some of his, you know, from people giving him from credit or credibility for all the great music he made.
Did it hurt him that he was never a sex symbol?
Well, you know, I mean, there's a period of time, you know, when he's making this music, you know, it's a totally different time. We're talking about here the early 50s, the mid-50s, and you know, I mean, there was a lot less of a dependence on image.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, put out records, people wouldn't know. They put out some of these records without his face on them. You know, I mean, you could put out music and there wasn't like the dependence on what somebody looked like. And when Rock Around the Clock hit and he became this huge star, you know, he would go and he was in movies and he was on TV shows, and he was kind of this big, stocky guy who looked, yeah, he looked kind of square. But it didn't matter because it was all about the music.
Yeah.
It was only after that, you know, the door was kind of opened, and guys like Elvis, the real sexy guys, they started going through, and that kind of changed things.
What Elvis opened for him on a number of occasions. What sort of relationship did the two have?
They apparently had a pretty good one. You know, I mean, they were doing these little one-nighter tours after Bill Haley had become a rock star in 54, and Elvis was just starting out. And Colonel Parker apparently called up Bill's manager and said, "Hey, I got this, you know, this kid. Can we get him on there?" "Yeah, sure." And they got him on, and Elvis was, you know, this polite kid. And Bill at that point was a little bit older than average. I mean, he was 29, 30 years old. And here's this kid who was very, very polite and called him Mr. Haley. And they had I don't know if it was a mentor relationship, but it was definitely a kid coming up and the old pro. And they kept a pretty good relationship. Although after Elvis became huge, Bill, it kind of became a thing for Bill that he couldn't understand why Elvis had gotten so big and Bill had not, kept getting big himself. I mean, there was kind of a chip on his shoulder about Elvis that he apparently kept the rest of his life.
Yeah, because initially when he went to tour England in 1957, they were calling him Bill Haley, the King of Rock and Roll.
Absolutely. I mean, and when Bill Haley hit England, I mean, there was this riot at Waterloo Station. Thousands of kids showed up, and it was just this pandemonium. I mean, nobody had seen anything like this. I mean, everybody was going crazy. I mean, apparently there were women with Bill Haley tattoos. I mean, he was this huge. It's hard to imagine now. I mean, there hadn't been anything like this before. I mean, Beatlemania is a few years away in America. Bill Haley was causing these kinds of reactions not only in England, in Australia, in all kinds of places. I mean, this music really. You forget now, but this music really did grab people. They'd never heard anything like it. And here was this American rock star coming over, and they didn't care that he was a little pudgy and had a curl. And, you know, they loved the music. The music was so great, and they all went crazy.
Get out in that kitchen and rattle those pots and pans. Get out in that kitchen and rattle. Cause I'm a hungry man. I said shake, rattle and roll. 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 Well, you never do nothing to save your doggone soul. Wearing those dresses, your head done up so nice.
Shake, Rattle, and Roll, Bill Haley and His Comets, 1954, I think that recording was. Now, Michael, Bill Haley wrote some of his hits, and he also recorded other people's songs. And I guess there's a huge difference in how much money you make depending on whether you perform the song or whether you have the publishing rights. Is that correct? Okay, we have lost Michael Hall on the line. We will bring him back right now. But let's see. Nilifer, let's play cut four, See You Later, Alligator.
See you later, alligator.
Well, I saw my baby walking with another man today. Well, I saw my baby walking with another man today. She told me, nearly made me lose my head.
That is Bill Haley and His Comets, See You Later, Alligator. 1955 was that. It sounded very much like Elmo was on the front of that, but is that the original part of that song?
I believe so, yes. That was Bill's last big hit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And as I was mentioning, I'm sorry we lost you. Thanks for getting back on the line with us. There's a big difference in how much money you make as a recording artist if you have the publishing rights to a song or if you've just recorded it. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
He didn't write that. He wrote Crazy Man Crazy. He wrote a few of the others, but a lot of these songs were songs that he covered. I mean, Rocket 88, Rock This Joint, and, you know, Rock Around the Clock was another one. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, you get a lot of your money when you record a song and it becomes a hit, because that's the gift that keeps giving. But the other royalties you get just for record sales, and once that record stops selling, you stop getting money for it.
And he seems to have had some poor luck in terms of hiring people to help him manage all that money.
He was, you know, he was like this small-town kid, and he had friends, and he was very loyal to his friends, and he would hire them as his manager or as his booking agent. And even when a couple of them turned out to be, you know, not very good at what they did and would make unbelievably foolish choices, buying up all this weird art, thinking that they would make some money off of it, or just it didn't work out very well. And the worst thing for him was his manager stopped socking away money. You know, this is a cash business, mm-hmm. but the IRS certainly was keeping an eye on him. He was this huge entertainer, big star. They didn't sock away money to pay the IRS, and the IRS came after them, and Bill basically fled the country.
So he goes to Mexico, where he's not going to have to pay the IRS, and in fact becomes a gigantic star south of the border.
Yeah, I mean, this is a part of the story nobody really knows. And the thing is, he had worked out his problems with the IRS. He started playing in Mexico and other countries, too. But the problems with the IRS got resolved, but he liked it down there so much. I mean, they were putting him in movies and TV shows. He was Bill Haley, Jesus Cometas. And he started Chubby Checker, who was also from Philadelphia, had this huge hit with The Twist. And so Bill Haley started, he was down in Mexico, and he signed a recording contract with this Mexican label, and he started doing his own versions of The Twist, The Florida Twist, Twist Español, and he recorded all these versions of The Twist, and they were huge hits south of the border, and he became this giant rock star in Mexico.
Did he?
Not just Mexico, Central America, South America. It was amazing.
Did he speak Spanish?
Not until he married a Mexican woman, mm-hmm. Martha.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and Martha would coach him on it. And apparently she told me she would stand next to him in the studio. You know, he would be singing these songs in Espanol, and she would be telling him the lines to sing. This great image, because she was so devoted to him, and she was kind of, you know, at his hip.
Here's a cut from later in his career, 1967, but you definitely get that sense of the Latin influence. This is Jealous Heart.
Jealous heart, oh, jealous heart, stop beating. Can't you see the damage you have done? You have driven her away forever. Jealous heart,
so that is a beautiful song, Michael Hall. But by 1967, the tastes of American teenagers and British teenagers had changed.
Yeah. No, I mean, Bill was kind of, you know, country. I mean, this is a big theme of my story, is country was in his heart. I mean, that's a country song done in a kind of, a south of the border way. That was where his heart lay at this point. And but, you know, that's not. And so he did that kind of thing very rarely. He was definitely trying to keep up with what was going on in the rest of the country. The flip side of that, he did that. He did two recordings on that day in 1967. The other one was a song that he did with this garage rock, kind of psychedelic rock band in Phoenix, Arizona, and they were this band that was kind of hip around there, and Bill was trying to, you know, kind of latch on to what the kids were doing, but it didn't work out very well. You know, I mean, by then he was, you know, much older than everybody around him, and was in some ways a fish out of water. Although there were all these, it may be in America, but over in England particularly, I mean, they still looked on him as this hero, this rock hero, as a founding in England, Germany, places like that. Back then and still today, they look on him as this founding father of rock and roll. So even in 67, 68, they just thought he was wonderful.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Ian on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Oh, afternoon.
Go right ahead, please.
Yes, this is all quite familiar to me because I was actually there when it happened.
Oh, really? In England?
54, you know. And it's difficult for you to imagine what it was like before 54, 55. The music scene was just not there. Things like, you know, how much is that doggy in the window? And Rudolph, it was dreadful. And then this guy comes. Did he first appear in a movie called Blackboard Jungle as the music?
Yeah, well, that was the big break. You know, that Rock Around the Clock was used in the opening credits of that movie, and apparently in England the kids were like, you know, ripping the seats. They went so crazy over it.
Well, Ian, I guess you probably remember this. You mentioned how much is that doggy in the window. It's a cute song, but it's tough to dance to. And suddenly Bill Haley gave you something that made you want to move. Is that right, Ian?
Hello?
Oh, yeah. I mean, do you remember dancing to the music as well?
I'm sorry, you're very faint.
Oh, do you remember dancing to Bill Haley?
Well, I can remember.
Oops, I'm sorry. All right. Well, sorry, we have lost Ian there. But anyway, it was, you write in the piece, Michael, that there was before Rock Around the Clock and after Rock Around the Clock. And it's a really firm dividing line in terms of music history.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that the Billboard charts even go up to 1955, or 54, and then they start again in 55. I mean, 55 is the modern era in many things, but especially in popular music. And it really does begin with Rock Around the Clock, which is, you know, one of my whole points in doing this story was to try and give Bill Haley his place in rock and roll and in popular culture, because he's not really given that credit. I mean, everybody gives the credit to Elvis and Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis, and they deserve plenty of credit. But Bill did it first, and he was doing it several years before, and he was doing it in this way that literally changed the world, and he should get credit for that.
Michael Hall is with us. He's senior editor for Texas Monthly Magazine, and his article Falling Comet appears in the issue that is on newsstands now. If you'd like to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Crazy man, crazy. Crazy man, crazy. Crazy man, crazy. Oh man, that music's gone, gone. I said crazy man, crazy. Crazy man, crazy. Crazy man, crazy. Oh man, that music's gone, gone. When I go out and I want a treat, find me a band with a solid beat. Take my chick and we dance about. When they start rocking more, we start shouting, shout. Crazy man, crazy. Crazy man, crazy. Crazy man, crazy.
Crazy Man Crazy, Bill Haley and His Comets, 1953. My guest this hour, Michael Hall, senior editor with Texas Monthly and author of the article Falling Comet, which is in the issue on newsstands now. So that song, Michael, Crazy Man Crazy, by Bill Haley and His Comets, first rock and roll song in history to hit the Billboard charts.
Right. And it's funny. I mean, I think that's 1953. Mm-hmm. He wrote that song. They were playing a lot of gigs at high school assemblies.
Wow.
You know, I mean, they knew that the kids were where it was at, you know, and they knew that they had to get something that the kids would dig. And he would go around these assemblies, and he carried a notebook, and he heard kids saying stuff like, crazy, man, crazy. And so he set out to write songs trying to, he was a smart guy. How do I get to the kids? So he he was older. He was in his mid to late 20s. He wrote these songs trying to capture the kid lingo, and it worked.
And he is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but amazingly, he was not in the sort of freshman class that was first inducted.
Right. The freshman class that was in 1986, of course, Elvis, and of course, Chuck Berry, and of course, Jerry Lee Lewis, and of course, Little Richard, and some other people, but not Bill Haley. Bill had to wait till the second year. And, you know, I mean, he's always kind of suffered that thing, whatever it is. I mean, he was a little bit of a square, whether it's the curl or whether it's the fact that people just identify him with, you know, kind of songs like Crazy Man Crazy, you know, these kind of wild dance songs. They don't give him the kind of credit that they give to the other guys. So he did get in, but, you know, he should have gone in that first year.
How much of a factor was his sort of on-again, off-again celebrity in his drinking later in his life?
I'm sorry.
How much of a factor was later on in his life when he was drinking quite heavily, was the fact that he wasn't a big star all the time anymore a major driver of his alcoholism?
You know, I don't really know. I think probably. You know, I mean, he wasn't. I mean, the people I talked to said that he didn't really start drinking heavily until the 60s, but he was touring all the time. And everybody he toured with drank, and that's what you did. You went on the road, and these guys are touring in station wagons, you know? And they're traveling long distances and, you know, or in Cadillacs, you know, big cars. And it was a hard life. And I think that was probably when the drinking began. And, yeah, it was definitely some of the stories I heard in the 70s when he would when he was increasingly bitter over Elvis and some of the other people being kind of considered rock and roll statesmen. And even though he would play occasionally big gigs in front of a lot of people in Berlin or some Australia, he was still going back and he was playing Holiday Inns and he was touring around, you know, this really hard life. And that seems to have been something that fed his alcoholism, yes.
We have an email here from John in Dallas who writes, earlier it was mentioned Haley's interest in and promotion of R&B while serving as a DJ. Did he ever give any interviews later in his life in which he discussed race relations in music, or more specifically, what he felt the integration of music did to advance racial understanding?
Not really. I mean, he was touring. I mean, what's pretty interesting is when Bill Haley first broke, he was the headlining name on a couple of tours where everybody else on the show was black. All these R&B groups, Big Joe Turner, all of these R&B bands that were doing really well on the race charts. He would go out with them, and I mean, he had some hair raising stories about being in the South and getting a real sense of just how horrible it was. I mean, these were his people, the people who he was performing with, doing their songs, you know, hanging out with on the bus, and yet they couldn't stay in the same hotels, and you know, he was witnessing, you know, all kinds of, you know, terrible behavior and all. And he writes about that. He kept a couple of journals, and he writes about that. He was very cognizant of it. He didn't really go out of his way to, you know, he wasn't like a crusader or anything, but he was definitely aware of you know, crazy discrepancies between what he went through and what the other musicians went through who just had different skin color.
What kind of impact did it have on his career and his fortunes when Rock Around the Clock in particular was used in American Graffiti and then as the original opening theme for Happy Days?
And, you know, that's... both of those are when I first came to him. You know, one of the things that I discovered in the story is that song kept coming back and being a hit for him. Different labels would put it out. He would re-record them. He re-recorded it in Mexico. He re-recorded it when he signed with a Swedish label. He kept re-recording that song, and it kept getting used because it's such a great song. And he kept having these revivals in his career, 1964, 68, and then in 1973 when it was used in American Graffiti. And I still remember going to see that in the theater, and that's the first song you hear over the opening credits when at the drive-in, when the girls are skating around, and you know the main characters are driving up to the drive-in early in the morning of that day that's in that movie. And then a year later, it was used in Happy Days, which was the biggest show in America. And so all of a sudden, he became, you know, a rock star again. And you know, at the time, he was down in Veracruz, down in Mexico, but he started playing again, started getting out there because there was demand for him. He had a huge hit. I mean, he was back in the top tens and top 20s again.
Do you happen to know why Happy Days switched after a season or two to that insipid theme that people might remember better today?
I don't know. It's just horrible. It's just, these happy days are yours and mine. Can't get it out of my head, though.
Sorry about that. I'm going to leave you with that for the rest of the day. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with John in Fort Worth. Hey, John.
Hello, Chris. Michael, I'm wondering if you are familiar with the Tom Russell song, Bill Haley.
Yeah, the song that he wrote with Dave Alvin.
Dave Alvin, right.
Yeah. And that was the first time when I heard that song. I think it's called Haley's Comet. That was the first time that I heard about this Texas story. It's this great song the two of them wrote. And it's basically based on newspaper accounts after he died in 1981. And it's pretty sordid. I mean, it just kind of points up the sad part of the story, and some of that sadness also I know comes through in the Texas Monthly story. But that was the first time I heard about it, yeah.
What did it take for his kids to come to terms with having to sort of keep this secret or somewhat secret when they were growing up, this thing that surely they must have been very proud of?
Well, yeah, they're very proud of him, but, you know, they also know that, you know, Pedro was you know, very young when this was going on. He was nine when his father was going through his final, you know, bad year,
yeah.
months and years.
Yeah.
His little sister Gina was four. Martha Maria was 16 or 17 in high school. So they were very impressionable kids while their father was going through these unpredictable mood swings, you know, and he was a very good father. You know, he doted on them. You know, because by that point he wasn't playing anymore. He'd given up music, he'd given up touring, and he spent time with his kids. And yet at the same time, there was clearly something else going on with him. When he finally did get checked by a psychiatrist, the psychiatrist said that he thought there was something, an imbalance with a chemical in his brain, and that there was a physical manifestation for this whole thing. And the kids had a really hard time with that because he would go back and forth between this sweet, doting dad and being an unpredictable, raging alcoholic.
When you go back and read those journals, and I know you mentioned in the piece that he thought for a time about writing his own autobiography, was he pretty self-aware?
In the sense of realizing about his fame or his life or...
Yeah, just sort of knowing who he really was, and I mean, was he in denial about how things had gone, or how well did he understand himself? And you know, it's hard to apply 2011 standards to a question
sure.
like this. But what do you think?
He was definitely an old school guy. You know, I mean, he was not one of those guys who, you know, when Bill Haley kept a journal, it was, you know, Frankfurt, 6 p.m. load in,
yeah,
8 o'clock show. Bill Haley did not write about his feelings.
Uh-huh.
He knew that he had done something great. You know, I mean, I think that he had gone up and down so much, and he was at that point so far removed from the source of it, you know, from those days, you know, 1955 when he was at the top. I don't know that, and because he was, you know, he had a real chip on his shoulder about people who did get, you know, more credit, like Elvis. I don't know that he could really put himself in the pantheon I think he knew that he belonged up there, and he knew he'd done something great, but I don't think he was very comfortable with that. You know, I mean, I think that probably had something to do with his unhappiness and his drinking in his final days.
Michael Hall is senior editor at Texas Monthly Magazine. His article, Falling Comet, appears in the issue that is on newsstands right now. Michael, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed talking about Bill Haley.
We will leave you this hour with a 1970 recording by Bill Haley and his comments of Rock Around the Clock.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, the hour is late. The tapes are running out. We would like to say one thing. Thank you very much. Rock and Roll Revival. If it means having audiences like you and places like this to work, why, I think the New York Post said today, I didn't expect them to print it, but they did in the article today, and I mean it. When I'm 75, and if you can still clap your hands, I can still hold a guitar. We'll still have rock and roll. I'll still be playing, all right?
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.